This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. In the Murdaugh trial, defense attorney Jim Griffin cross-examined the state's last key witness, Dr. Kenneth Kinsey, a crime scene investigator, about his report and expert opinion on the defense theory that two shooters could have been involved in the murders of Maggie and Paul. Despite the cross-examination, Dr. Kinsey stood firm in his testimony and offered additional explanations as to why he believes the theory is not sound. Take a listen.
Jury is present, sir.
All right, thank you, Mr. Griffin. Yes, sir.
Dr. Kinsey, I'm still talking about the quail pen. You remember how tall off the ground that defect is?
I do not from memory, Mr. Griffin.
If I would show you Agent Wardley's report, take a look at it. We don't want, it's already in evidence somewhere, but if you could just tell the jury, and if that's consistent with your understanding of how high that defect is.
Four-foot, 2 inches?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And did you inspect, when you were out there, did you inspect the entry in the quail pen or the damage to the shop behind the quail pen at all?
I looked at all of it, but I did not run any angles.
Okay. And did you ever talk to Agent Worley about her measurements?
I did. Yes, sir. I did interview Agent Worley about her work on the scene.
Where was that?
Back the first or second week of December at the New Sled Laboratory.
Okay.
I can give you an exact date if I look back through my notes.
I don't need that. Okay. But are you being compensated for your time?
I am, yes, sir.
And how much have you been paid thus far, and how much you hope to get paid before it's all said and done?
Well, I'm a Baptist, so if I didn't charge something, my friends and family would talk bad about me. But, my retainer is $2,500, and I have a flat $100 an hour rate. And when I added it up, I was up a little over 100 hours. But I ended my retainer myself without anyone asking me to do a little over a week and a half ago. And I'm now working off of a mutual aid agreement that my sheriff's allowing me to do that, Sheriff Leroy Ravenel from Orangeburg.
Sure.
So I'm not charging anything from a little bit before last week on.
So 100 hours, $100, is that?
That's money? Roughly, I have expended roughly, not all of it was daytime, but if I take off, I have to use personal leave from work to do this work. So roughly 75, 80 hours I have used of time from work.
Okay, so you've made $7,500, $10,000?
Well, I've spent way more than that running up and down the highways, Mr. Griffin. I've probably been to 20 meetings or so, but yes, sir, if you look at it that way.
Okay. Now, Doug, back to exhibit.
But I will be going up next week.
Exhibit 140, and if you'll go to slide 31, please. I think it's the right number. Yeah. So this is from Mr. Sutton, and it's got, let's just focus on the angle going in the quail pen. This is not a height issue. This is the angle. Do you have any disagreement with this angle?
I don't. The only problem I have with it, I know there was a side-by-side there, and I don't see the side-by-side depicted on this photograph. So looking at it, I could not tell you how that would play into that angle.
Okay. But the quail pen's 4 feet, the defect in the quail pen's 4 feet, 2 inches off the ground, and according to Agent Worley, the shot angle is rising either 1 degree or 1.5 degrees or 3 degrees. Is that consistent?
That's accurate, yes, sir.
Well, let me ask you, do you believe the shot angle is rising? I mean, you may not agree with the exact angle, but do you believe it's rising toward the quail pen?
Well, I believe it could be. Yes, sir, I do.
Do you believe it could be a downward
I do
trajectory?
Not believe, looking at it, that it could be downward. No, sir.
So we can eliminate downward.
Well, if you're going by my results, I'm saying that I don't believe it's downward.
Okay. And so if it's going upward, and then you take that line back that we see, this line, at some point in time, it's going to go into the ground, will it not?
It should, yes, sir.
And do you know where that terminal point is, roughly?
I have no idea, Mr. Griffin. As I said, I know I've got a moving victim. I know I've got a moving suspect. I know there's a lot of movement. I don't see where that's worth 25 cent or a quarter one way or the other. It gives me an idea that this is a fluid and dynamic crime scene.
Well, if you had confidence in the vertical angle, then you would be able to determine the, depending on where along the way, you would be able to determine the height of the muzzle of the gun if you had confidence in the angle.
Well, I'd have to know a bunch of unknowns also. How the shooter's holding the gun, how tall the shooter is, the
would
distance,
you?
Did he move a shell casing, did he not? I mean, I don't know those things, and I'm not going to make them up.
No, I mean, would you have to know all those things to know how high the muzzle is off the ground at any point along that line?
If you give me a fixed point and I knew that I had a strategic fixed position I was shooting, I could run a tape measure and know where they were at.
And it doesn't matter whether it's a 7.4, 6.4, 4.4 person. The muzzle's going to be at a fixed spot, right?
That's the way angles work, yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Now, on this Faro, and Faro is the sled does Faro work, do they not?
Yes, sir.
And it is the state-of-the-art technology in scanning and getting measurements?
It is the new thing. We use the sketch pad and a pencil, but I do understand the technical part of it.
And would you agree with me that the feed room would be about right in here? Can you see that? You want to come down and point out where the feed room would be at, on this angle? Excuse me, on this Faro? And I'll give you a, I thought I would.
I believe it's right here.
Right there at the end of the structure?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Yes, sir.
And I guess you don't have the measurements, but do you know roughly how far this line, this angle, would be away from the corner of that structure?
I have no idea, Mr. Griffin.
You've not done that math?
No, sir, and I saw no need to if all the shell casings are up here by the shed.
Okay. All right. I want to go back to Paul and his injuries, and the and I guess the first I want to talk about your analysis. Y'all have been critical of Mr. Palmbach and Dr. Eisenstadt, but under your analysis, the shot of the gun was up through the left shoulder, jaw, and out the top of the head.
Correct? Yes, sir. That is my opinion.
And you, I'm going to come up here, and this is the feed room door here. I just want to understand where you have Paul under your analysis. Is Paul on this side?
Which shot, Mr. Griffin?
The last shot.
The fatal shot?
Yes, sir.
Well, as I mentioned in my report, I would assume he's closer to this wall because I've got a void 6 inches below that light switch. If you look at the outside photograph of that building, there's a silver light cover on the wall. And about 6 inches below that, I've got one stray satellite drop of blood, and then it's fairly clean. You've got some outliers, but it's fairly clean going down.
Okay. So you think Paul is closer And this would be the door, and it's swung open. So you think Paul is closer to this side?
Well, I think it would have to be Paul because the angle wouldn't match up if the shooter was here and Paul was over there. It wouldn't match up either way. Whether it was down in the head or up in the head, it still wouldn't match up either way if Paul was against the hinge side of the door.
And Paul is standing roughly how I'm standing?
No, sir. As I demonstrated, well, we tried to demonstrate, me and Mr. Harpootlian were kind of dancing up here, but I believe he come out with his head down. He's drooped on the left side, and he come out on this side with his shoulder just outside the room. Yes, sir. About like that.
Okay. And then the shooter is off to Paul's left?
Yes, sir. From this side. Yes, sir.
And the shooter has a shotgun, right?
Absolutely.
And he is some 2.5 feet away?
Well,
I mean, the barrel is 2.5 feet away?
That's what Dr. Reamer said. Yes, sir.
What do you say?
I don't believe it was that far away. But I'm not, like I said in my earlier testimony, I'm not going to contradict a pathologist. She knows more about the human body than I do.
All right. But you don't mind contradicting Dr. Eisenstadt?
Well, because I've been to the scene and I've reviewed all this evidence. Yes, sir. That is correct.
Okay. Well, that's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say, let's take 2.5 feet from the end of the muzzle. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, sir. That is.
And then you've got to back the shooter up to hold the gun. And I guess if you got it 45 degrees, right?
Well, as mentioned a dozen times so far, I don't know how long this shotgun is.
Okay,
but it would be here, and I don't know where he's standing, most probably behind this wall, because Paul is stumbling toward him. So here.
So the shooter's shooting left-handed, you think?
I don't know if he's left or right-handed, Mr. Griffin.
Okay.
I don't know that part.
Right.
But that angle would match up, despite all the...
That matches up.
Yes, sir. That would match up.
Now tell me, in that angle, and this dowels the gun, where's that shot shell going if it ejects?
If I'm pointing into the room, it could go inside the room.
Well, you just raise it up to... I mean, that's under your angle.
But I'm behind the gun. I'm behind the gun, so that's going to push the weapon out a little bit. The ejection port's on the right, so the shell could easily end up in that room.
If Paul's standing there and the end of the muzzle is 2.5 feet away?
Yes, sir.
You're saying eject in the room?
The door is this wide. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
At 45 degrees?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It's doable. Yes, sir.
And then under your analysis.
Your analysis?
Your analysis.
Oh, my analysis. Okay.
Your analysis.
Yes, sir.
We're not there. We're not there. We're still in court. The shot's going up through Paul, chest, jaw, out the top of his head.
Yes, sir.
Number 2 bird shot.
Number 2 steel shot, dry lock, 3-inch. Yes, sir.
And you counted, and I think you said 150, 156, I can't remember.
Well, the literature says 156. I was like 150, but I kept getting tired of counting, and I think I kept messing up. So I'm going to say the literature is probably correct.
Okay. And I think there were some 60 to 70 that were found in his body, at least.
I have no reason to doubt that. No, sir. Okay. I didn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, count them on the x-ray, but I believe that.
Okay. And Doug, if you'll pull up, please, Defendant's Exhibit 188, which is in evidence. I don't want to do that one. Hang on. Let's do a crime scene photo. And folks, this is going to be a sealed exhibit, so please cover your monitors. This is Defendant's 193 as soon as we're ready. So you tell us, you recognize this photo?
Yes, sir.
And this is the door?
Yes, sir.
And this part of the door is blood spatter?
Yes, sir, it is.
And this, and then there's hair?
There is hair. There's a little bit of bone, and there's some other body tissue.
Okay. And there, you think, where is Paul in relation to the door at this
He
point?
Would be right where I showed you, off at 135-ish, give or take a few degrees, closer to this side, so you could make that angle. You can look at the directionality in the blood and tell which direction it's going.
Okay. And coming out of the top of his head would be 75 steel pellets?
Yes, sir. That's no other way for him to get out. Yes, sir.
And you went out there and you found one indentation.
Well, it's an indentation, but that is a little deceptive because you can see the paint damage to the top of the door. One indent is what I found, but I said bullet defects. The S got dropped from that. But if you zoom in on that, you can see where the door, the paint was disturbed around that indentation. But one proves it didn't go back the other direction, Mr. Griffin. It doesn't take a lot.
So if you'll pull up 188, the defendants in evidence 188, and this is not under seal. 188, please. And zoom in on the indentation.
There's actually several you're cutting in on that one, but.
So you say there are more defects on the door?
Yes, sir.
Did you document any defects that you observed on the door?
I got them in a photograph. I can show you. I mean,
okay.
What other documentation did I need to do it to verify that that's the same door?
No, I'm just talking about other pellet marks on the
There are other pellet marks on there. Yes, sir. You just cut that one down, but if you move up a little bit, you can see the little indentions right there in the paint.
All right, back it up, Doug.
Right above the hinge, right here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Okay.
There's several of them there.
And then you see this pellet here in the...
I did not see that, but I'm vertically challenged, and I wish I could have looked up and saw that pellet, but I did not see that pellet lodged in that door frame. But I'm glad, Mr. Maybach, Pombach, however you say his name, I'm glad he found it because that even proves my point a little bit more.
So I'm going to ask you,
mm-hmm.
According to your shot angle, how would a pellet get there?
It's... Really? I mean, it's a cone. Mr. Griffin, I've already described how a shot pattern works. It's a cone.
So this missed his head, you think?
No, it come out of his head.
Okay.
And the ones in the floor in the feed room probably also come out of his head. They bounced off that door, the OSB, and in the feed room.
Okay. And so you believe that this pellet that's in the door jamb came through his shoulder, through his neck, out the top of his head, and ended up at that location.
Well, it didn't turn around and come back out the top of his head. Yes, sir, I do believe that.
Well, now, you said there's blowback 8 to 10%. What do you mean? You testified earlier there's blowback about 8
If someone is behind the stock of a long gun and you shoot someone within distance to have high velocity spatter come back at you, it's going to be 8 to 10% of what's in front of the gun is going to come back at you, and a lot of the literature supports that.
Well, were you let me show you, and this is under seal. Please cover up, and it's Defendant's Exhibit 192. Under seal, 192. Do you see that?
What?
This photo.
Yes, sir.
Now, this blood spatter down here where you say Paul would be standing, what's your explanation for that?
What do you mean, what's my explanation?
What is it?
That is medium directional blood spatter.
From what injury to Paul?
Probably his brain hitting the sidewalk would be my best guess, but that's not high velocity.
Now, you understand what Mr. Palmback said was that that's more consistent with Paul being shot from the top of the head, going through his neck, out his shoulder, and producing that stain.
I also understand Mr. Palmback said there's no damage over here from those shot pellets, and you can't have one without the other. I disagree with that result.
So you believe this is from Paul's brain landing?
Either his brain landing on the sidewalk, bouncing off the door, or either his body falling in body fluids outside. That's low velocity, low to medium velocity. That's not high velocity blood spatter. That's stomping in a puddle of blood or something moving in a puddle of blood. That's not the projected blood like you'd have a millimeter or less in high velocity blood spatter. That's large. It does show some directionality. It's coming from the door frame or either right outside the door frame, but it's large. That's way too large to be associated with the exit hole of a gunshot.
So you understand his brain landed feet outside?
I do understand, Mr. Griffin, but I also know his brain made contact with that door and the top of that door frame before it landed. And I know gravity works and brings body fluids back down to earth. Okay. You got one or the other, either that or when he fell in existing blood. That is low velocity. Like I said, that's associated with something in a puddle or something large. That's not associated with a gunshot or high-speed machinery.
Now, would you agree this is a voiding area over here on the door?
I wouldn't agree it's a void area because I don't see the outline of shoes, or I don't see the outline of a implement or the outline of anything else. I would say there's more concentrated blood droplets over here on the side opposite the hinge, but I would not necessarily agree that's a void area. I see downward spatter on the door right here. For it to be a void, that would have to be absent blood.
Well, you see a little bit.
I do, yes, sir.
But you don't see very much blood on the door.
Not compared to the other side. You're correct.
Okay. Now,
but if there's something there, Mr. Griffin, blocking that spot, you're not going to see a little bit. You're going to see none. If you're standing there and I splash you with blood, there's going to be two perfect bloodless footprints there. So that's why I'm not considering this a void.
Unless it goes up and comes down.
Gravity brings it down. That is right. And if your person had time to move or whatever, I guess that could count for it. But
I don't consider it over the person and came down.
And that would do what?
If body matter went over, brain went over, hit the top of the door, and then bounced out, and blood came down, that would account for a drop here or there, would it not?
It could count for a drop here or there, but like I told you, the majority of that force is applied upward.
Right.
Upward. That's why you got the hair on the ceiling. That's why you've got the demarcation line on the containers. That body fluid was directed upward with force.
Okay. And the, you mentioned there's no footprints here. Was any effort made to illuminate footwear impressions through any protein enhancers?
I didn't see any of that, Mr. Griffin, if they did. I saw no evidence of that when I went back to the scene. Generally, when you use dye stains and that kind of thing, it's just going to be there forever.
Dye stain would have picked up perhaps stained footwear impressions you can't see with the naked eye, wouldn't they?
It may have if someone had stepped in blood and left a footwear impression.
Right. Well, there's a shooter somewhere inside or outside the door, correct?
Yes, sir. I agree with that.
And there's no effort to determine footwear impressions of the shooter.
Mr. Griffin, obviously, I don't know. I don't know what the process was. I know they examined some partial footwear impressions.
You can take this down, Doug.
But I don't know how far they went beyond that.
Well, they certainly should have gone further than they did. Would you agree with that?
Mr. Griffin, I can only judge what I would do, and sometimes I would, sometimes I wouldn't. If I saw evidence that I had something, that I needed some more detail, I may would use chemicals, but it just depends on the situation.
Kenzie, I'm going to show you what we marked as defendants exhibit 197 and 196. And I'll ask you first, 197, do you recognize that as essentially a picture outside the feeding door?
Yes, sir, I do.
And Your Honor, would move 197 into evidence this time without objection, I believe.
Without objection.
Are you offering both of them?
Yes, sir.
Any objection to either?
No objection, Your Honor.
They're both admitted.
All right, 196. Dr. Kenzie, what would you make of those pock marks on the concrete outside the feed room door?
I don't know, Mr. Griffin. I don't know what they are.
Could they be pellet?
I guess they could be.
All right.
They could be from a pressure washer also.
You have these? Okay, great. So we're seeing for the jury 197, and then can you zoom in there? Can you, Doug, go to 196, please. So those could be from a pressure washer, and those could be from a number two birdshot pellets, correct?
Well, I don't know. I have to see the cement everywhere else to see how it's weathered.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Now, last few questions. You mentioned that that you had seen some 12 execution-style killings with contact wounds to the head.
I said I've worked about 36 total. Probably 12 of them were homicides to the head. The execution thing, I don't know if it's execution or just contact, but I would say it's self-inflicted as opposed to someone else doing it.
Well, so let's get it right. 36 total, I thought.
Probably 36 total, yes, sir. And two-thirds of that was probably self-inflicted, so that would leave 12.
Self-inflicted are usually under the chin and the mouth on the side?
Well, the one that I witnessed was to the forehead.
To the forehead?
Yes, sir.
Now, of the 36, how many were shotguns?
No, I've worked a lot of self-inflicted gunshot deaths. I was saying shotguns, about 36.
So 36 shotguns.
Yes, sir.
Roughly 12.
And a couple of them were accidents, too, but yes, sir.
Okay. And the and how many involved number two birdshot?
I don't recall. I had some with birdshot. I don't recall if it was number two, four, eight, nine. I don't know.
And how many were to the back of the head?
Probably a dozen were to the head. Contact either the back or the sides or the one I told you about in the front.
Okay. And any of those, did the brain evacuate from the skull cavity?
I have seen them. I have seen the brains come out. Usually that was from one here. I'm not going to say I haven't seen it. I probably have seen it. But most definitely, like I said earlier when I described it, it looks like it goes away. It's really still there. It's just not something you can quantify. I mean, it's just a mess. That's the only way I can explain it.
In your career, have you ever worked a case where a victim's brain had been evacuated the way Paul's was in this case?
Yes, sir, I have. And tongues also. Tongue and brain. I have seen them. Yes, sir.
And were those self-inflicted?
Both.
Okay.
Yes, sir, both.
And you're talking about shotgun?
Yes, sir, shotguns.
Okay. And I think you described those as execution-style killings?
Yes, sir. I would. If you put it on somebody's head from the side or the top, I would. That's how I would describe it.
Well, let me ask you: would you describe Paul's murder here as an execution-style killing?
In the context that someone executed him, yes, sir. But it wasn't in the top of the head.
I understand.
Yes, sir.
And that, and there was no signs of struggle. You agree with that?
I saw none. No, sir.
And would you agree with Mr. Palmback that it appeared that Paul got caught by surprise?
I've said that from the start. That would account for his arms being down. Okay. Yes, sir.
And?
Or someone he was real comfortable with.
And even under your analysis, the shooter would have blood, blowback blood on them. Is that correct?
I believe they would. Yes, sir.
It's just a matter of the quantity between you and Mr. Palmback as to how much blood would...
Well, as I mentioned in my report, as you get closer to the muzzle of the gun, I think proportionally it's going to increase. You know, when I said 8 to 10% is what most of the literature says, that's behind the stock. But as you get proportionately closer to the muzzle end of the gun, that's going to increase because you're down at the business end where those pellets right. are coming out doing damage.
And in this case, you're talking about brain matter?
Yes, sir.
Blood?
Bone, yes, sir.
And getting hit from some skull fragments?
Yes, sir, that's possible.
Under your scenario as well?
Yes, sir, absolutely.
And lastly, how many murder have you worked where one person brings a high-powered assault weapon that has a magazine capacity of 20 or more rounds and a shotgun with maximum capacity maybe 3 shells?
Well, I have worked multiple murders where the available weapons there were used and several calibers were used, but I can't tell you from memory the other ones.
Logically, it would make sense that if you're going to go kill two people and you have a high-powered weapon with a high-capacity magazine, that was all you need to do the job, right?
Well, if the weapon's available, Mr. Griffin, if it's there and it's available and maybe it wasn't something that I put a lot of thought in, I'm probably going to use whatever's available.
Well, here we know there were two weapons available. There was a 12-gauge shotgun and a AR-15-style 300 blackout.
Yes, sir.
And both were used.
Yes, sir.
And there was sufficient capacity in the 300 blackout to kill both Maggie and Paul, correct?
Well, in a perfect scenario, a shotgun is what I would want at night with moving targets. But in a perfect scenario, a young man doesn't take a double-aught buckshot to the middle of the chest and walk away from it. So I don't know. I don't think like that. I don't know. But in the dark, I'd rather have a shotgun than that rifle.
One more line of questioning. You demonstrated Mr. Palmbach's shot from the top of the head with Attorney General Wilson a moment ago?
Yes, sir.
Now, that was Mr. Palmbach never put anybody inside the door the way y'all demonstrated in his testimony, did he?
That is the way I understood it. Yes, sir.
Well, I mean, he said that. Well, can you come up here, Mr.
I mean, with the void, you're talking about the void. He said there's a void here, and this is where I believe the shooter would be, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. So if you'll come up here, Mr. Arbutlin, and let me find the dowel.
Let me bend down. Don't let him bend down like that.
So if you're coming out of threat, so you're going to get down.
Down?
Yeah, get down. Almost to the ground.
Bend over like this.
Further? All the way. Yeah, you probably need to get down further, but you probably can't do that. But the shot to the head as it's coming out, right? Or boom.
He'd have to be twisted this way for it to work out with the arm if that would be.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
But that's fine. That's fine. But Mr. Palmbach never said that they passed in the doorway, did he?
He might not have said those words, but that was my inference, that there's a void there. And when he's in the picture holding his hands here,
right.
I took that to be Paul's head. So that's...
All right. Well, okay, did y'all understand when he was in the picture there, he was demonstrating what your angle had to be to make it work?
Well, I wasn't in the door with my angle.
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
That's all we have.
Thank you.
All right.
Briefly, Your Honor. All right. Dr. Kinsey, you've had an opportunity to speak with Dr. Reimer, the pathologist that actually examined Maggie and Paul, correct?
Yes, sir, I have.
And you had an opportunity to observe and listen to the testimony of Dr. I think it's Eisenstadt, who was the pathologist that did not examine Maggie and Paul, correct?
Yes, sir, I have.
You've also had an opportunity to go to the crime scene and observe the feed room, observe the areas where both Maggie and Paul were murdered, correct?
That is correct.
You've had an opportunity to observe all the brain matter and tissue and the defects and the doors and the wood and everything and get a complete context for what happened that night, correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Is Dr. Reimer or Dr. Eisenstadt's conclusions about the trauma to the bodies, which one of them is more consistent with what happened at the crime scene as you observe with your expert background?
Well, I'll start by saying I don't know either one of them from a can of paint. This was my first time ever meeting Dr. Reimer, but my opinions are consistent with hers. I vary a little bit on the distance, but like I said, I'm not going to argue with a pathologist. That's not I'm not that kind of doctor.
Real quick, you differ with her a little bit on the distance of what?
Of the fatal shot to Paul's shoulder, I believe it was a little bit closer, and I can't account for that lack of stippling, but other than that, her opinions and my opinions are fairly consistent.
But that would not change, that difference of opinion would not change your conclusions either way?
No, sir, they would not.
For the sake of this redirect, let's assume for a moment that the angle of impact and the direction that the defense posed were accurate. Are there other variables that a defense expert didn't account for that could change the height of the shooter?
Well, as I demonstrated, positioning, distance, height, the way you're holding the weapon that could place those cartridge cases there, it's nothing uniform about it. As I said, it's static and dynamic.
So the shooter is running around, and the victim is moving, correct?
Yes, sir.
It's chaotic.
Yes, sir.
It's crazy.
Yes, sir. I would imagine it was.
There's no way to know, unless you were there, how the gun was being shouldered, where it was being held, the angle. There's no way to know that.
I have no way of knowing that.
You were asked about how much you were being paid to be here today. Do you recall what the hourly rates of the defense experts were when they testified?
I do.
Can you go ahead and tell me what those were?
Some was $350 an hour, some was $650 an hour, and I think one was $5,500 a day, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh. Jim, pictures you just put into evidence. Oh. I got them right here. I just found them. Thank you. Okay, I'm showing you what's marked as State's Exhibit 197. Do you know when that picture was taken?
I have no idea.
Okay, sir. I'm showing you what's been marked as Defendant's Exhibit 196. Do you know when that picture was taken?
I have no idea. No, sir.
Is there anything about the defects of that photo that stand out to you other than just concrete defects?
They're not very uniform. But no, sir, other than that.
Does that photo tell you anything?
It tells me nothing. No, sir.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Quite well.
Anything further?
No, Your
Honor. Thank you. You may step down. Any further witnesses by the state?
Your Honor, in the rebuttal case, the state.
That's the latest that we have for you right here. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussions on this case. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.